Well, I think there is one question over there.
Sure.
On the last page, the note at the bottom, it's at the very bottom, says bottom of activism on specifically indigenous issues.
What's that?
It's the note at the very bottom.
Yes.
I mean, we've got the cure and we've got the note.
Yeah. But, I'll give you the context for that.
Please. I-N-M? What is I-N-M?
I don't know more.
Oh, there we go.
And I put a couple of snarky things there. I mean, so which one, what specific snarky thing are you looking at here?
We're talking about activism.
Right.
On specifically indigenous issues.
Well, I consider Idle No More activism of the best order. I actually recommend it in the again in my book on Indian residential schools, and I talk about it in more detail there. And it's another one of those things I think that I should talk about more. But a lot of people think equate activism with I don't know, marching and occupying and demonstrating and so on. I don't. I think a lot of that is just useless, frankly. I would be supportive of it. The way that I look at activism kinds of things, though, is asking yourself very solidly the question, what am I willing to do? See, Idle No More is, as far as I can see, they don't really know what they're doing. They're just mad. And so somebody suggests something and they all go off and do that. I think that's very positive. I think you can overthink these kinds of things. I don't know if you're familiar with Taylor Branch's biography of Martin Luther King. Three volumes. It's humongous. One of the great things about that work, and I'm finding all kinds of things. I lived through this time period, and I'm like, holy cow, that's really what was going on, my God. Is the complexity. I personally was a co-founder of the American Indian Movement in Canada in 1972 in London, Ontario. And we got followed around. I personally was followed around by the RCMP for 2 years. Now, what I was advocating was that we go back to our reserve, we plow it up, we grow vegetables, and then we give it up to everybody for free. I didn't see exactly why I was a threat to the internal security of Canada by advocating that. I don't see that somebody who shows up to a fracking protest here in New Brunswick with cookies and coffee for people, I don't see why that's a threat. But I do see that as activism. I say that people should be asking themselves what they're willing to do for a better world. One of the things that we have to understand is what a better world consists in. And I would say as an absolute minimum, breathable air, drinkable water, those kinds of things are absolute minimums. And so you should ask yourself, what am I willing to do for that? The difficulty I would have with Idle No More is that it is totally a non-intellectual enterprise. One of the emphases of the is that we're being systematically misled about this specific issue. Why Indians are committing suicide and what we should do about it, it's bogus. If you read my book on residential schools, you're going to find, he says that we're being systematically misled about the residential schools and the issues as identified are bogus. If you read my works on education, what we're being taught about Indian education is systematically misleading and bogus. So there is a continuity to my way of looking at what appear to be to these two people. People are presented these as a whole bunch of separate issues. I see it as one issue. Okay? This is what's lacking in the Idle No More. They think they're dealing with this issue, and then this issue, and then this issue. And it will be easy for the government of Canada to pick it off at the moment that it chooses to pick it off. This is also, again, a lesson of Taylor Branch's analysis of Martin Luther King, that the function of your organization is to bail out the people who you considered your leaders, then you have changed what it was that your organization was supposed to be doing. Your organization was supposed to be doing this and this and this. And if you get locked up and sent to jail, okay, well, we got to get the leaders out. Well, suddenly everybody's doing that instead. And there's a breakdown. It happened in the American Indian Movement also. I can attest to that directly and personally. People just did not understand at the time. And so what I would hope to be able to do to groups like our, it's not a group, to a movement like Idle No More, is to get people to understand the overall context of what's happening and why. I mean, this is the beauty of this entire approach. I didn't even go into it today, but I do link, we do spend, this is Shaughnessy's thesis, spend enormous times linking this up to Marx's, we don't call it a theory, it's a description. Marx's description of alienation and its inseparable integral relation with capitalism. Let me quote myself here. I've got something a little bit more. Where's Roland's copy? Because I've lost Roland's copy. Do I know? You've got Roland's copy. No, it's got to be the one that says Roland's copy. I mean, where is it? See, I was hiding things from Shaughnessy today, too. Yeah, somebody's got Roland's copy, and it isn't Roland. All right. You see, the big issue is, the background issue for me is capitalism. In the 1844 Economic and Philosophical Manuscripts, Marx makes a plea for what now is called humanist Marxism. A lot of Marxists repudiate 1844. They say Marx wasn't Marx yet, and he wasn't really talking about the real issues. He's not mature until he gets to almost capital and so on. I'm not of that opinion. I'm of the opinion that his 1844 Economic Philosophical Manuscripts is his breakthrough. It's here where he sees the vision of everything that he's going to do for the rest of his career. And so his position is, I think his language is a little bit wrong, because it has been clarified philosophically. I mean, this took another 150 years. But he's describing the situation that if the crucial feature of capitalism is that it separates workmanship from ownership. if the defining feature of what capitalism is that workers do not own what they make, and owners do not make what they own. And you can talk about profit-making and mass reproduction and all those other things. Those are derivative phenomena. But in the separation of workmanship from ownership, they're entailed in that. They're not add-ons. They are just different ways of saying the same thing. There is an alienation between humanity and humans. Whatever it means, whatever human nature is, separating workmanship from ownership separates humans from humanity, from human nature. Secondly, it separates individual people from their notions of self. Thirdly, it separates individual people from their notions of community. And fourthly, it separates individual people from nature. Not human nature, big nature, mother nature. And his argument is that is not to present this as some kind of an empirical assertion. This is just an elaboration of the definition of what capitalism is. The point that we make in the book is that the oppression of the Canadian government is to get us to assimilate. They call it assimilation, I call it genocide. Why? Because the assimilation is to give up whatever your form of life is and adopt our form of life. So our question is, then what is your form of life? Your form of life, the one that they're putting the gun to our head, oppressing us, to adopt, is the separation of workmanship from ownership. Whatever else native societies were traditionally, historically, we were not alienated. Capitalism wasn't even known in Europe until post-1492. So we weren't capitalists. We did not separate workmanship from ownership. To demand that we do that now, that's under the pretense that there is no relation. You can work as a good Canadian, you can get a job 9 to 5, and then you can go home on the weekend and put on your headdress and go woo 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 woo. Do you see? You can be both an Indian and a good Canadian. What Marx says in 1844 is that's not possible. Once you have been pulled into the orbit of a form of productive society in which workmanship and ownership are separated from each other, you have a capitalist form of life. Well, that's not an Indian form of life. I know it's not Iroquois. Shaughnessy assures me it's not Mi'kmaq or Maliseet. So you can find me some capitalist Indians. Maybe it's consistent with their form of life. Whatever the Canadian government's been trying to get us to do is to not behave like Indians anymore. Well, what does that mean? If it means that we're going to be alienated, that means that we're going to be separated from our humanity. Maybe it's a common humanity, but whatever. We're still separated from it. We are going to be separated from our own notions of self. We're going to have our separated from our notions of community. We're going to be separated from nature. Those are four things that did not happen to us, because we weren't capitalists. So the lie is that you can work within a Canadian political economic system, but you can still be a good Indian. And the lie is that you can't. That as soon as you've assimilated, you've ceased to be an Indian. This is the lie of Sean Attlio again, and everybody before him, frankly, because they haven't seen it either. When the white paper was articulated in 1969, Chrétien. I was there. I mean, I was part of this. The outcry against it. Do you know who wrote the Citizens Plus? A lot of people don't know this. Jackass and his father out in Alberta. the Reform Party. Preston Manning and his father. Preston Manning and his father got a grant from the Alberta Chiefs to write Citizens Plus. The Chiefs didn't know what they were complaining about. Preston Manning did? No. Was Preston Manning writing an Indian manifesto? No, but he knew how to make $250,000. See, capitalists are perfectly willing to do it. Take off my pants, $250,000. Okay, here you go. There goes my pants. So Preston Manning was willing to write an Indian manifesto. Why it was written, though, was that the Chiefs got mad. Everybody got mad. Every Indian that I know in 1969 said, this policy, this announced policy paper, demands that we give up being Indians. And we're not going to do that. Somebody write us a paper. Here's $250,000. Somebody write us a paper that will complain about that. Enter Preston Manning and his father. They had a law firm. Okay? Sean Atleo comes along and says that Indian economic development is salvation for Indians. Nobody says squat. In my lifetime, we've moved from a native population in which everybody, even though they couldn't articulate exactly what their objections were, they knew that they objected, to a system that could actually give credence to such a moron, mindless jerk as that. We don't understand. The Idle No More movement was really in a response to a lot of the things that was going on in collusion between Sean Atleo and Harper. It was Atleo's participation in these kinds of things that gave rise to Idle No More. I don't think that Idle No More knows any more precisely about what it is that they're objecting to Harper's policies than the chiefs in Alberta did in 1969 to Chrétien's paper. I don't think that they've got any more sophisticated. Education hasn't got better. Just the stuff that I'm talking about today with Marx on suicide. You think college students know that now? Do you think suicidologists have read this? I mean, we're living in a society that's claiming accomplishment for less and less. We have people running around with letters after their name that I wouldn't let wash my car because I don't think that they know enough about what goes into it to do it. So the Idle No More is a pure heart movement. They hear this and they don't like the sound of it. And so they go off and they do something. I think Marx gave us in 1845 a blueprint for why it is that this is just so objectionable to us. Whatever we are, whether we're Plains Cree or Iroquois in Upper New York State or Southern Ontario, it doesn't really matter. We know when suddenly we're being told we have to start behaving like this instead of like that. We say, well, that's not our way. That's not us. We don't all have to have one way for us to see that this way is different from all of us. So let's pretend there are 600 Indian nations. There's probably more, but let's pretend only 600 in Canada in 1491. There's probably 600 plus then different forms of life. There's no unity to that whatsoever. But all of them were ways of not being capitalists. None of us had hit on this is how we're going to conduct our form of life. So I'm all about praxis. Marx is about praxis. The other philosopher I follow strongly is Wittgenstein. Wittgenstein is 100% about praxis. It's a doing. Being an Indian, oh, okay, well, you get a tan and that makes you an Indian. Well, really, then you could. There's certain products that you can go and buy at the drugstore that will turn you into an Indian. If you want, you just smear it on and there you go. No. We have to understand that that it was action, being an Indian, doing Indian things, doing the Indian stuff, whether it was doing the Oneida stuff or doing the Mi'kmaq stuff, that constituted us as our nations. Instead, what we're being told was, it is now, is that these correlates. Oh, well, you have to have a fringed leather jacket. Ah, I see. That was what being an Indian was. Hey, okay, tan? Yes, okay. Headband. This is why I put a headband on Bob. You see, we didn't know he was an Indian until I put a headband on him. But now we can see. We're being told that these pedimenta, these appurtenances, are the phenomenon. When the phenomenon is really a form of life that has a basis in an entirely different relation to the material world. We didn't separate workmanship from ownership, period. And if we have a form of life that does, then we're not Indians anymore. And I think the idle no more people, I would be much happier if we had some kind of an intellectual base to what it is that we're doing. I think the knee-jerk response is right. First time I ever got in front of a class teaching them about Native resistance, I said, whatever the policy of the government is, your policy is to do the opposite. Mm-hmm. That's what your policy is. And I said, now, I don't want to give this as a general rule because the government will sooner or later figure that out and then, you know, then it comes psyching each other out. So we eventually have to understand what it is that we do that's different. We have to understand it intellectually. We understand it irrationally now in a stimulus-response sense, and right now, okay, then let's do that. They tell us to do that, we do the opposite. Okay, well, you shouldn't lose your language. Okay, then we're going to study our language. You shouldn't have your traditional political systems. Okay, then we're in favor of traditional political systems, and so on and so on. But sooner or later, it's got to stop being knee-jerk, and it has to be for deep, enduring reasons that we really understand. One of our difficulties is that we never intellectualized about that. I mean, if somebody said, I can't imagine Iroquois in 1491 standing around saying, what is it to be a Mohawk? I don't know. Let's have a conversation. What is Mohawkism? No, we would do Mohawkism. Being a Mohawk was behaving like a Mohawk. Well, how does a Mohawk behave? Follow me around and you're going to see. This is me doing it is how we behave. So the point is that we never had to defend it. So we never had to worry about it. We may have had conflicts with neighboring First Nations, but the Mohawks weren't trying to go around and make other people into Mohawks. There's some rumor that the Maliseets are combination of Mi'kmaq with Mohawks. No, neither side will admit this. There are suspicious reasons for doing it. So nobody had to defend being a Mi'kmaq because there's still Mi'kmaq around. Nobody had to defend being Mohawks. There's still Mohawks around. But there's a group of people now that grew up that call themselves Maliseets that are seen to be somewhere halfway in between. Well, good. That wasn't done by a war. That wasn't done by invasion. That wasn't done by locking people up and taking over their school system, etc., etc., etc. It was an action. It was people behaving. So we didn't have to intellectualize about Mohawkism or Oneidaism or Creeism or anything like that because it wasn't under attack. It's only been under attack when somebody comes along with something so foreign as to say, so unhuman. This is Marx's point. This is why people say, they call it Marxist humanism. is that the action of separating workmanship from ownership is ultimately a dehumanizing action. That's the fatal step. And I agree with him. I don't agree with his notion of what human is, but I do agree with his argument that it's inherently dehumanizing. So we do spend considerable time talking about that in the book. We just don't have time to go into it today. The Idle No More people as a movement, I'm fully supportive of it. I wouldn't change one thing. I would change the notion of formalizing it and turning it into some kind of a bureaucratic structure, because the bureaucratic structures have the deficiency that they can be pulled apart by a dedicated group of oppressors. And that's been the history of American Indian Movement, the American Civil Rights Movement, etc., etc.
I almost hate to bring this up, but I could sit here and listen to this all day. So anyway, I'm glad you clarified that, because the very last sentence in the second page of the it's okay. You don't need to. It was just the idea that the proper treatment for the Indian suicide problem isn't to send cheerleaders into our communities. It is the elimination of the system that is destroying our lives, which is capitalism. So of course, next question is, then what?
Then what?
And I know this is the rest of our lives, so to speak. So
I go back to behave like in Oneida, as far as I can. I do.
Yeah.
You see this day? Yesterday it wasn't like this. I was trying to save my plants from drowning. If I wasn't here today, I'd be in my garden putting them in the ground, which is where I wanted to do. Why? Oneidas were farmers. I farm. I don't farm. I grow enough vegetables for me and my friend. Shanti gets some of it. She does some of the work. When Marx talks about it's dehumanizing, like it says, it not only destroys humanity in you, it destroys your notion of self, your notion of community. This is very important. We have all these artificial tricks for building mainstream community. Oh, we're going to have a Christmas tree lighting ceremony in front of City Hall. Oh, yeah. City of 50,000 people and what, 75 people will show up? Boy, is that community or what? My world, the world that I connect to, is not a metropolitan area with thousands of people in it. You just can't know that. I want to know the people around me. And when I say no, remember, we can only know each other by our actions, and that includes our verbal actions. That's it. What's really going on behind, inside here, we're not privy to. It doesn't matter how clever or sophisticated it is. It's interesting that they're trying to convince us more and more that science is getting closer. Oh, the images they have of the head that's in your head when you're thinking, they're getting clearer, and they don't stop to ask, what's the eye inside the brain watching that picture? And how does it know how to make sense out of that picture? It's an infinite regress. And to answer, oh, there's turtles all the way down, is not an answer to the question. You know, Wittgenstein has a better solution, and that is describe. Don't try to explain. This is why I say, I think Marx's discussion of alienation is a description, not a theory. He's not offering it as an empirical phenomenon subject to empirical test. It's not a suggestion at all. What would we do if we didn't have capitalism? Give me not capitalism, and I'll tell you. I have an idea how it would work. I think we would all become more engaged in real human activities, such as what are we going to eat, how am I going to stay warm this winter, and things like that. Is that wrong? No. People live for millions of years under those kinds of conditions. And I think we would build communities where we took seriously the welfare of the people around us as extensions of us. But I don't want to be a capitalist. I'm forced to swim in the ocean that they've created.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we're probably going to have to wrap it up now. But thanks a lot, Roland Chardasi, for doing this. Tracy, did you have something?
Just, oh, can you thank you, Carl?
Yeah.